And welcome back to the locker room. We're in the home stretch now, Greg, and we've got Robert Kelmer, who, well, a lot of people wouldn't know that name. We do, Rob, because we've read all about it. And I heard you being interviewed on the breakfast show on Monday with Brendan and Brody, and that was interesting. And we'll touch on that for a moment, but we're going to focus on your time as a sports psychologist. But welcome.
Thanks, Neil, and welcome, listeners. Nice to be here.
Yeah, actually, you're a local in Mount Martha nowadays.
Yes, I've spent probably just off the top of my head the last 30 years on the peninsula.
Okay, good. Now, let's talk about sports psychologist. Oh, you've got your own practice, Headstrong Personal Development Services. But the bit we're going to focus on is going, and it goes back into the 70s or 90s, let's get clear here, back at St Kilda, around about the time when Stan Elves was coaching, I believe, and you had some involvement in the club?
Yes, I actually had an involvement unofficially since about 1970.
Oh, okay.
Because Gary Colling and I
met
each other at Caulfield Tech, where we were both teaching as PE teachers. And being a mate of Gary at that time, and he still is, he lives around the corner from me. And from that day on, I tended to be going to St Kilda and training and everything like that with him at various times. So that's basically the starting point. And then Stan Elves was later on, mainly during the 90s, in the lock at Robert Harvey days.
So when you went down there and started getting involved at the club in the 1970s, was it a relatively new thing then, Robert, for sports psychologists to be involved in football clubs?
In the 1970s, there would have been hardly a club that had a sports psychologist. Mm. And even in the 90s, coaches were kind of very wary of sports psychologists. Mm. Now they wouldn't be without one, but in those days, they didn't like other people messing with the brains of their players. Well, that's the way they viewed it at that time.
Interesting. So, I mean, Stan Elves, I've always thought, did a great job with St Kilda in those times. He was there about 4 or 5 years and had a pretty good record. What was your impression sort of from the inside as to how he went about it?
Well, I really liked Stan.
Yeah.
I still do. I mean, he's a really good guy and certainly put his heart and soul into it. He did wear his heart on his sleeve a bit at times, but I really respect the guy, and he did a great job for the club. He probably, by today's standards, I made a comment about Footscray and the changing in the code, the way coaches now approach the game and the people they have playing with them. So, yeah, there is a big difference between then and now, but that goes across all clubs.
In fact, you spoke about, heard you mentioning on Monday about Luke Beveridge and being quite impressed by his approach. Is there anything particular you like about the way that Luke Beveridge went about the job?
Yes, sure, Neil. One of the things I always did as a teacher, teaching 15, 16-year-olds, was never to berate a boy in front of the rest of the class. Yep. I'd always wait for my moment to get him aside
and
then
talk
about do whatever needs to be done and deal with it in that way. And I think, yes, I know John, his father, and he is a bit of a philosopher himself too. Yep. And I can see that coming out, and he's obviously had a lot of help from his mother. So I saw that in the papers. And Lucas, his attitude, I think, is ideal, because I think a lot of coaches talk a lot but don't listen very often.
Interesting.
And so, Robert, would all AFL clubs these days have a sports psychologist on staff?
Oh, yes, they would.
They would?
Yes, they would.
Because I'm just thinking, in the general community, it's only a percentage of people, I guess, that would feel the need to go to a psychologist. Is it also only a percentage of sports people that benefit from the services of a sports psychologist, do you think? Or Is it a different situation there? You know, can you do things, positive things with all players and all
yes.
comers?
The answer is, I had a client call me only a few days ago, and she asked me whether I could see her, because she said before competitions I can put her in the zone.
Mm.
And, you know, I wasn't looking for that, but she said, and I thought, well, that's great, mm. because that's what it's all about. It's about getting players ready for competition, mm. and getting them in the right frame of mind, getting them relaxed, getting them to enjoy the experience. It's not just about, it's small steps,
mm.
and throughout the game, reassessing and evaluating, and being able to do the job.
You hear about a lot of sports, you know, Greg and I have had an involvement with cricket as an example, and a lot of people say that it's 90% of cricket's actually above the neck, that is, you know, how you approach it mentally. Do you think that's true in AFL and in many sports from your experience there?
I would say without doubt in every sport,
mm.
Golf and cricket especially,
mm.
They're both mainly above the shoulders. If you have any kind of ability mm. physically,
yeah.
of course, it's up top that matters. And, of course, commitment and dedication to what you're doing. You have to train and perfect. It's like learning music. If you're learning music, I'm a muso as well.
Yeah.
And if you're learning chords, it's just over and over and over and over. There's no shortcuts, mm. you know,
yeah.
that sort of thing.
And, of course, you've got many skills. You're a painter and also an author, and you've just released your latest book recently, which is titled...
Distant Echoes.
Distant Echoes. And I believe there's a reference in that to your time, even though it's a fictional piece, to your time at St Kilda Football Club.
Yes, there are references. I wrote two books so far, Creeping Shadows and Distant Echoes, which mm. is a sequel.
Mm.
And it's also about a story within a story of how to survive tragedy, how to overcome adversity,
mm.
how do you handle these things when you're really devastated about something? How do you climb out of that? So the two books, they link up, and yes, sport comes into it at various times,
mm.
but it's more about the ability to regroup, and in that way it does belong in sport, because mm. when you have a devastating loss in footy, I heard the interview with Taieb, mm. and I commend them for being so dedicated and sticking with everybody. I think that's the way to go. I wish them well.
Mm.
And, so it's a bit of everything.
Mm. And, of course, a lot of it's based, or is it only based loosely, I'm not sure, on your own life and trials and tribulations that you've experienced.
In your book.
Yeah. Mm. One of the characters in the book's Joe. Because originally I came from the Netherlands,
mm.
and so I was living in an occupied country as a child,
mm.
but I came out here and to this great country, and of course sport here is so big that I just naturally fell into it. So I guess that's true.
Mm.
Mm. Just looking on... just a bit of research here, Greg.
Mm.
The Australian Psychological Society, Sports and Exercise Psychology. And they sort of just talk about some of the areas which this covers. So I'm just going to throw a couple at you here.
Yeah, sure.
Put a bit of pressure
go for
on
it.
So one of them talks about performance enhancement and mental skill development. Now, I from that previous discussion we had, I can see how those things connect, but are there any key things there about getting the mental approach right so that you can maximise your performance?
Yes, well, I have to say it's very different between Roger Federer
mm-hmm.
and Joe Selwood.
Yep.
One plays a team game, mm. they're both champions,
yep.
the other plays single tennis.
Yep.
So really, there's a vast difference, because in a team game, you have to adapt not only your own game, but you've got to adapt to everybody else's and your opposition as well. So that's in a way easier because in a way you can hide.
Yep.
You can't hide if you're on a court
on your own.
On the other side of a net. That's there's no choice. Right. So
that one, in terms of the team, might come to another area which is listed here, which is communication skills and conflict resolution. Now, I can imagine that in a team game, you've got to all be working in the same direction. You've got to be able to sort out any of those little communication problems or conflict problems that you'd have.
Yes, you do. However, one of the things that used to frustrate me a bit and still does, there's a time and place, you know, for all these things. And I still would strongly recommend if I wasn't retired, I don't like after game meetings for players because they're absolutely finished, they're tired.
Yeah, physically worn out, mentally drained.
Mentally drained. Yeah. The coach wants to talk to them.
Yeah.
And I'd say, nah, not the right time. Nah. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Walk away,
yeah.
Go back in 2 days' time, talk to the boys.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of, in the earlier days, it was more like a sergeant getting his troops together and yelling at them and trying to push them to the brink by aggression in a way.
Provoking them,
Whereas now, I think that's the difference with Luke Beveridge. Luke Beveridge kind of, I think, has a very even, fair approach, which includes discipline and respect by the coach for his players, and the players respect the coach. It doesn't mean to say he goes easy on them, but it's a different ball game, and I think that's the way it ought to be.
You only have to look at some of those, the old vision of coaches screaming at their players at three-quarter time.
The old Ron Barassi days.
Yeah, exactly. Ron Barassi, Ted Whitten.
Alan Killigrew. Now, there's another one who was very much onto that fire and brimstone, but you don't see as much of it nowadays.
No.
When do you think the penny started to drop with the coaches that, you know, the smarter way of doing it, the way we're talking about now, the current way?
Well, the coaches that I respect are Paul Roos.
Yes.
The current Sydney coach.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think they're level-headed guys that actually take time out and don't accept that they are totally responsible for the team's performance.
Mm-hmm.
In the days that I was involved, coaches would not delegate much at all, and they felt totally responsible for the result. You know, it was a terrible environment to work in because there was a lot of stress that could have been handled better.
Mm.
So I think football's come a long way to this point, but it can still go a bit further in being able to communicate better and listen to more what the players have to say too, rather than just talking at them like teachers do.
Yeah.
Some teachers will just talk at kids.
Yeah.
Well, you know, some coaches will just talk and assume that the players know what they are talking about.
Mm.
And they don't stop to ask or ask themselves, did I get the message across?
And one of the other areas in this list I'm looking at is anxiety and stress management. I'm just wondering how the coach themselves feel about that anxiety and stress management. And I'll bet you back in the days you're talking about earlier on, the coach wouldn't be asking the sports psychologist for a bit of support in the anxiety stress management area.
No, you're right, Neil. You're perfectly right. In fact, as I said before, we were sort of witch doctors in those days. But I really think, and I hope, I can only suppose that today they would have mentors, that each coach, I think, needs somebody. I mean, you have people in psychologists and ambulancemen and policemen.
Mm.
They need to chill out and they need to go to other people, other police and other psychologists and other people to let it all out and let it bleed, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
But in my day, the coach swallowed it all up.
Mm.
And I'm hoping that now that wouldn't be the case.
Mm. Interesting.
And there's been plenty of examples recently in the news about elite sports people who, after their life in sport, have a lot of difficulty adjusting. Do you think the AFL clubs, because we're talking AFL, do enough for their players when they retire? Is there a need to perhaps have a hands-on approach to those players as they find themselves out of the limelight?
Yes, Greg. We do have the AFL Players Association, of course, and they are also interested in welfare of the players after they leave footy. I think it used to be terrible. I think they just had nowhere to go.
Mm.
And a recent case was with that swimming, Olympic swimmer that, you know, you imagine going in a pool at the age of 12 and swimming up and down it for about 10 years or more,
yeah,
and then coming out and expecting to lead a normal life.
Mm.
I think it's pretty much impossible unless something's put in place that can allow that to happen.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, Michael's been listening. You've joined us in the studio for the last few minutes, Mick, and no doubt you're fascinated by some of the discussions that are going on.
Been an interesting chat, actually. I've sort of caught your chat with John, and I've sort of caught the chat here as well. And the Australian cricket team, for argument's sake, like normally it was just like
which is the one Greg mentioned
11
earlier,
players,
yeah,
the coach, the physio, and now all of a sudden there's like 25 staff or something, or extra staff over there. You sort of touched on it before, but I just wanted sort of roundabout sort of way. When did the sports psychologists actually? When did it first become prominent? When did clubs sort of say, look, we've got to have one?
When did it move from that point where you started, Robert, where you're the witch doctor, maybe?
Would have been in the 90s. I worked through the 90s. Before that, the clubs are starting to think they needed one, even if it was for prestige.
Yeah.
You know, in the US, everybody had sports psychologists.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be without one.
Yeah.
So AFL clubs thought, oh, we have to have one.
We better do that.
But, you know, it was funny, but most of clubs wouldn't put a sports psychologist on the people that were employed by the club. You'd have a board with everybody put up there, but there wouldn't be a sports psychologist. That could happen.
Mm.
So it was very low-key, and we weren't really trusted.
Yeah.
Do we have to follow everything that America do, though?
I reckon there was that stage where, and I know Mick Malthouse and a few others went over to America during the break, that they'd spend a month over there or England, and just to find out what the latest the latest things were, and they're trying to keep up the sport around the world.
So
I reckon it came from that.
You're happy that we follow America?
I didn't say that. I'm just saying I think that's where this particular idea came from, and I can see the merit of having somebody with a psychology background involved in the leadership group around major sporting clubs. I can see it makes a lot of sense, which is slightly different to the way you put it, but that's how I would put it. Mm.
Rudy Webster, remember Rudy? Did you know Rudy Webster, Robert? He's the name that springs to mind.
He was the guy
West Indian fellow, wasn't he?
Wasn't Rudy Webster the guy that went from Carlton to Richmond, and he was a psychologist at Richmond, and Tony Jewell and Percy Jones had that famous fight at Beerville Park in the second semi in 1980?
I think you might be right. It might be linked into the...
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. very interesting. Rob, it's been fantastic. We're going to have to wrap up soon. It's getting near the end. It's been fantastic chatting. If people are interested in the book, how do they do that? Distant Echoes, yeah. What's the easiest way to get that?
Farrell's.
At Farrell's in
Mornington.
One of
the best bookshops in the universe.
Great shop
in Mornington.
We love it. We love that shop. Absolutely. Yeah. Lovely people. Great shop.